You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the reading of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly Digital Edition. My name is Shari Mukundan. Today, I'll be reading several articles from the November 3rd issue of the Weekly and following up with miscellaneous articles. From the Perspectives on the World section. First the blade, then the ear, then the full grain in the ear. Find that common ground and they know they're being heard. Scott Baldoff, returning to the United States after two decades abroad, on how a reporter earns the trust necessary to tell Americans' stories. Read more on page 26. Infinite Prizes for Ideas on Progress by the Monitor's View, with a sketch illustration of a light bulb with an infinity symbol in the middle. Every few years, the Nobel Memorial Prize in Economic Sciences goes to thinkers who offer fresh insights on the sources of economic progress. A good example in this year's awards. They were given to three people, two with a theory about progress, creative destruction, and another who points to a culture of growth. Given this long record of Nobels, there appears to be no end to the idea that ideas on progress have no end. One of this year's winners, economic historian Joel Moyker, even states that growth depends heavily on an infinite source, what people believe, or specifically a societal perspective that not only expects more ideas to be discovered, but also makes them practical. This facilitates a continuous flow of innovation, such as clean energy or regenerative agriculture, that can provide sustainable growth. Dr. Moker's work on the origins of Britain's Industrial Revolution showed how a change of view in a country can unlock curiosity and creativity. By itself, material innovation is not the key, but rather the surrounding culture, such as a tolerance for failure in research, rule of law to protect patents, or an appreciation for the scientific method. And progress is not only always linear. Leonardo da Vinci, for example, designed an early version of a helicopter in the 15th century. Today, many experts claim artificial intelligence is more dangerous than it is transformative. Yet a society that sees progress as natural will spur new innovations, including ones that fix problems caused by past inventions. Openness is a driver of growth, one of this year's Nobel Prize winners, Philip Aguillon, told reporters in October. Anything that gets in the way of openness is an obstruction to growth. Ingenuity is a bottomless trait, and yet its role in economic growth requires the right set of conditions. Freedom, collaboration, equality, and receptivity to challenging ideas. Future economists might posit different causes of growth. The field has had to broaden its scope to many areas, from religion to quantum mechanics. One constant, however, is the boundless attempts to measure the immeasurable flow of inspiration that, despite fits and starts, uplifts humanity. Constantly fail to grasp how many ideas remain to be discovered, states a former Nobel winner in economics, Paul Romer. There might be no end to prizes for new theories of progress. Reviving Prosecutors' Integrity by the Monitor's View. Now, 9 months into his second term, President Donald Trump may be setting a new norm in law enforcement. Under his watch, prosecutors in the U.S. Justice Department have indicted three people who Mr. Trump believes have done him wrong. Former FBI Director James Comey, current New York Attorney General Letitia James, and his former National Security Advisor John Bolton. The courts may yet declare all three to be not guilty of charges against them. Yet the possibility of prosecutorial misconduct, such as for vindictiveness, has supercharged efforts to reset the norms of integrity. That is, pursuing justice over, in quotes, winning. That most prosecutors have honored for decades. For now, much of that norm resetting is at the state level, where millions of felonies and misdemeanors are handled each year by more than 2,300 prosecutor offices. And it is in the states where much of the problem lies. In about a third of cases in which someone is exonerated, the reason is prosecutorial misconduct. Yet only 4% of prosecutors who participated in a wrongful conviction have been disciplined, according to the National Registry of Exonerations. Some legal experts want the American Bar Association to toughen its rule that establish obligations and discipline for prosecutors. Many states have recently tweaked ethics codes for prosecutors, as well as for other government workers. This year, for example, New York State updated its ethics guidebook for prosecutors titled The Right Thing. Defense counsel protect their clients' interests and legal rights. Judges protect the party's rights and public's interest in the proper resolution of pending cases, the handbook states. But it's not their job to find the truth, decide who should be charged, or hold the perpetrator accountable. Only prosecutors are given that freedom, and with it the ethical duty to promote all these vital components of, in quotes, the right thing. Two states, Georgia and New York, have recently set up special bodies to oversee the conduct of prosecutors. The two commissions are very different. While they represent a new approach to the problem of, in quotes, rogue prosecutors, both are not seen as bipartisan enough. And rather than assisting prosecutors in acting better, they are largely investigative or regulatory. Ethical principles are the essence of criminal prosecution, not a burden upon it. The New York Handbook states, helping prosecutors to act along those principles, either in the Trump Justice Department or in the local courthouse, is now on the docket in the United States. From the Behind the Scenes section, bringing a foreign eye to a domestic beat. How does a reporter who spent the last quarter century abroad get attuned to the American story again, and to American stories? By Clayton Collins, Director Editorial Innovation, and Jingan Pang, Multimedia Producer. With a photo illustration of Scott Baldoff, a man with gray hair, gray beard, round glasses, green fleece. Caption, on the road, Scott Baldoff, whose beat calls for wide-ranging U.S. travel, poses in Three Rivers, Michigan on October 12, 2025. Scott Baldoff has an advantage on his beat. The Monitor's American correspondent recently returned from 13 years living in Saudi Arabia. He lived outside the United States for about a dozen years before that. That gives Scott, an American, an international journalist's wide-open perspective. Effectively, we have no other choice, he says, adding his family to the equation. We've lived overseas for so long, we have changed, and the country we left behind is a very different place than the one we left. Although now based near Washington, Scott's new beat means he has an ear-to-the-ground portfolio that entails getting far beyond the capital and out into the United States in order to tell America's stories, to tell Americans' stories. He started his stint with a look at his new hometown, Greenbelt, Maryland. There, as elsewhere, he listened to as many voices as possible to get as complete a picture as he could, to hear about solutions as well as problems, to get at motivations. At the end of the day, you are going to be asking the why questions, he says. Why do you believe what you believe? That sense of empathy and understanding of fairness builds trust. Scott says on our Why We Wrote This podcast, it's constructive to bring views together. Build there, and then find that common ground, he says. And they know they're being heard. Staff writer Scott Baldoff recently joined the Monitor podcast, Why We Wrote This, for a discussion on how he's bringing a foreign correspondent's perspective to his work covering the United States. To find the full interview at www.csmonitor.com/whywewrotethis, or launch your camera's smartphone, your smartphone's camera, point it at the QR code on the left, and tap the on-screen prompt when it appears. The Christian Science Monitor masthead. Editor, Krista Case Bryant. Managing Editor, Kurt Schillinger. Chief Editorial Writer, Clayton Jones. Editorial Writer, Armin Sentha. Print Editor, Stephanie Haynes. Deputy Weekly Edition Editor, Books Editor, April Austin. Director of Editorial Innovation, Clayton Collins. National News Editor, Mark Trumbull. Deputy National News Editor, Chelsea Sheasley. International News Editor, Peter Ford. Deputy International News Editor, Sarah Miller-Yana. Features Editor, Yvonne Zipp. Deputy Features Editor, Kim Campbell. Cover Story Editor, Harry Bruinis. Editor, The Home Front, Husna Haq. Senior Advisor, Trudy Palmer. Senior Newsroom Operations Coordinator, Melanie Golder. Staff Editors, Scott Blanchard, Arthur Bright, Ryan Lenora Brown, Whitney Ulick, Ken Kaplan, Liz Marlance, Lindsay McGinnis, Lydia Pembach, Mary Art B.W. Tabor, Angela Wang. Staff Writers and Special Correspondents, Scott Baldoff, Laurent Belzy, Colette Davidson, Linda Feldman, Henry Gass, Anna Maureen Grobe, Stephanie Hills, Story Hinckley, Stephen Humphreys, Patrick Johnson, Cameron Joseph, Francine Kiefer, Diane Kraft, Howard LaFranchi, Taylor Luck, Ken Malkin, Ali Martin, Sarah Matusik, Simon Montlake, Kendra Norden Beto, Erica Page, Scott Peterson, Ira Porter, Cameron Pugh, Troy Aiden Sambajan, Mark Sappenfield, Dominique Segal, Ned Temko, Ann Scott Tyson, Jackie Valley, Fred Weir. Chief Copy Editor, Judy Nichols Douglas. Deputy Copy Editor, Chris Hanna. Managing Editor Design, Julie Fallon. Director of Photography, Alfred Sosa. Staff Photographers, Melanie Stetson Freeman, Riley Robinson. Operations Manager, Lily Mew. Director, Graphics and Multimedia, Jacob Jercote. Lead Designer and Illustrator, Karen Norris. Multimedia Producer, Jing Jang Pang. Associate Multimedia Producer, Mackenzie Farkas. Godfrey Budge Sperling Reporting Fellow, Caitlin Babcock. From the Global Newsstand, Arab News, Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. Syrian elections herald a new era. For the first time since the overthrow of Bashar Assad in December 2024, Syrians went to the polls, writes Hani Hazamiya, senior editor. The legislative elections show that Syria is beginning to step toward a new era of unity. After nearly 14 years of war, Syrians have longed for institutions that reflect their collective will. These elections begin to create that possibility. The incomplete inclusion of Kurds, Christians, and women in this election is not the end of the story, but the beginning of a process that must expand. The new Syria is not yet built for all Syrians, but it is moving in that direction. Syrians are choosing unity over fragmentation. The Irish Times, Dublin. Data centers are good business, but only if the power's there. Last year, data centers accounted for an estimated 25% of Ireland's electricity usage, states an editorial. Energy demands from data centers is projected to increase by up to 165% by the end of the decade. The government must balance the demands posed by data centers on the national grid with the needs of domestic users and the economy. These facilities are a crucial component of the tech ecosystem in which Ireland is deeply embedded, but data centers are also a source of heavy CO2 emissions and are putting a strain on Ireland's efforts to meet its legally mandated European Union climate targets. Failure to meet these targets will result in potential fines of up to 26 billion euros, $30 billion, which more than offsets any economic benefits of data centers. Calgary Herald, Calgary, Alberta, with a sketch illustration of a grown-up holding a giant umbrella protecting a bunch of children from the rain. Teachers care for our kids. They deserve support. My son's teacher saved his life, writes Robin Walker, a parent in Calgary. My son was in the midst of a mental health crisis. His teacher was the first to notice his learning disability and encouraged assessments and supports. Teachers care deeply but are overwhelmed. With Alberta's teachers on strike in October, I see a system after its breaking point. I see dedicated professionals who are asked to perform miracles. Supporting teachers isn't about politics. It's about protecting the next generation. The Daily Star, Dhaka, Bangladesh. Poverty can be fixed with long-term inclusive policies. Around the world, countries have experimented with various models to reduce poverty, writes Salim Rayhan, an economics professor at Dhaka University. Three key models have emerged. The first is growth-led industrialization and export expansion, which pulled hundreds of millions of people out of poverty, as illustrated by China in the 1980s and early 1990s. The second model is the redistribution of wealth through welfare. The model has been used in Latin America. The third model is shared growth, fast economic development fueled by significant investment in health, education, and social protection and skills. The recent rise in poverty in Bangladesh is both a warning and a chance. Progress can go wrong if it's not open to everyone. Politicians, businesses, and regular people should look beyond quick fixes and work toward long-term change. The Standard, Nairobi, Kenya. Freedom to dissent online must be protected. Last year's Gen Z revolution started with a hashtag, writes Henry Ocheng, CEO of the Kenya Alliance of Resident Associations. What began as a social media outcry quickly snowballed into a movement. For the first time in Kenya, the government and political leaders bowed to the power of social media as a platform to push for accountability. However, a year later, the digital space is under threat. Online dissenters have lately faced harassment, unlawful arrests, or coordinated online attacks. The fight to protect the civil space in the digital era will only be won when authorities safeguard participation. Compiled by Victoria Kaufman, staff writer, illustration by Karen Norris, staff. From the home forum section, a cupboard full of wild books. When I want surprise and delight, I check out A Little Free Library by Danny Heitman, with a photo illustration of a box looking like a house with a door open, books inside, propped up on someone's front yard. A photo by Melanie Stetson, Freeman, staff. Caption, Bibliofind, A Little Free Library filled with books, stands outside a home in Hingham, Massachusetts, June 27th. Although I've scanned the book review pages in newspapers and magazines for years, I've come to a season in my reading life when my choices are often guided by my neighbors. In a nearby park, at the midpoint of my morning walk, I connect each day with A Little Free Library, one of those outdoor cabinets where readers can leave donated volumes and perhaps take home a few for themselves. Little Free Libraries started in 2009, when Todd Bowl built a simple box outside his home in Hudson, Wisconsin, and stocked it with books to share with his fellow residents. Mr. Bowl died in 2018, but his idea continues to flourish with some 200,000 registered Little Free Libraries around the world, according to the organization formed to champion Mr. Bowl's inspiration. At a time when anger and division loom large in the headlines, these miniature troves of literary treasure, broadly shared and open to all, are a reminder of what we can be at our best. The simple goodness of Little Free Libraries is easy to overlook these days, when new titles, the latest thriller, a hot-off-the-press whodunit, a just-released political tell-all, seem like the most fashionable books for the armchair or nightstand. But these Little Free Libraries, in so many places, including my Baton Rouge, Louisiana neighborhood, are abiding proof that recycled reads have their own appeal. Virginia Woolf said it best in her volume of essays, "Street haunting, secondhand books are wild books, homeless books. They have come together in vast flocks of variegated feather and have a charm which the domesticated volumes of the library lack." Wolf came to mind the other day as I opened the door of my local Little Free Library and found a paperback edition of her 1915 novel, The Voyage Out, on the top shelf. The pages were a little bit swollen, perhaps from the damp of a now-vanished summer in the lap of some unknown reader who dozed away near the shore. Or so I imagine, as I flipped through the chapters, looking for traces of a book's life before it came to rest in my hands. That's the real charm of these Little Free Libraries, I suppose, that in enjoying the plentitude of anonymous donors, we find ourselves within the folds of a community. What I also treasure about Little Free Libraries is their giddy sense of serendipity, the way they often seem to land a particular book with a right reader just when it's desired. I'd struggled with some of Wolfe's experimental fiction, but learning that The Voyage Out was a more traditional novel, I had set a goal to give it a try. My good intention had languished for months until spotting a copy of The Voyage Out in that Little Free Library provided just the nudge I needed. In a similar way, I've wanted to try my hand at the detective mysteries of Alexander McCall Smith. As if reading my mind, a secret benefactor had left a copy of Mr. McCall Smith's The Full Cupboard of Life inside the cabinet for me as I arrived to browse the other day. As if eavesdropping on my undeclared desires, an LFL patron deposited Randy Pausch and Jeffrey Zaslow's The Last Lecture on the giveaway shelf not long ago, a gift that almost had me skipping home to crack the spine on the author's wisdom. I'm halfway through The Voyage Out, and I have no idea what book will speak to me on my next visit to our Little Free Library. I'll open the cabinet doors, as any lifelong reader does, eager to know what happens next. Pause for Poetry. Bat in the House by Andrew Armstrong. How did you get in, and how will you get out? Quite rude of you to intrude and fly about. Flinging your shadow against the white walls, exploring every room, acrobatics in the hall. Yet I frightened you more than you frightened me, with my lights and my music and my giant TV. You wanted the dark and some insects to eat. I needed some peace and to put out my feet. I opened the windows, thinking the breeze would cue a poor bat how to exit with ease. The lights I extinguished, the kitchen vacated, ran out of the back door and waited and waited. At last you emerged, framed by the sky. With no chirp of thanks you went fluttering by. I crept up the steps, a little chagrined, shut all the windows and locked myself in, smiled rather sadly and was forced to concede that I was the captive and you were the freed. Giving Our Substance, A Christian Science Perspective by Karen Gould. Could it really be true that giving does not impoverish us in the service of our Maker, neither does withholding enrich us? As Mary Baker Eddy states in her textbook on Christian Science, Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures, page 79, I was praying to understand that this idea really is true when I was feeling unwell whilst on a city walking tour. As I reached out to God in prayer, something came to thought that Jesus said to his disciples, "Go ye into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature," Mark 16:15. I felt like replying, "But it's me that needs help." I was absorbed in material selfhood, Science and Health, page 91. That is, I was focused on fear and pain, thoughts of which would seem to get in the way of us hearing and obeying what God tells us. But having heard God's demand for unselfed love, I knew I could obey that demand and take a strong stand against being distracted by such thoughts that aren't from God. Instead, I could discern my spirituality and capability to love my neighbor as myself, as Jesus directed. A Christian Science practitioner that I asked via text to pray for me reminded me of God's omnipresence, that God is always with us, and that I am enfolded in his infinite love. Christian Science teaches that God is all, see Isaiah 45:6, and that we are inseparable from him. I prayed to understand my spiritual individuality as God knows me, made in God's likeness, and to understand true substance, which Science and Health says is that which is eternal and incapable of discord and decay, page 468. As God's reflection, therefore, we are wholly spiritual, imperishable, perfect, and free. As a reflection of God, who is infinite divine love, we are each blessed with God's abundant goodness and love, so we don't have a limited amount of love to give. We can give generously, effortlessly, and freely give to others. Even though I was still feeling unwell, when I noticed a woman nearby looking sad, I asked, "How are you doing?" Her eyes filled with tears. She explained that she was grieving the loss of her mother. I yearn to help her feel embraced in God's love. I shared ideas I have learned through Christian Science about God's omnipresent love and care for all. A Bible promise tells us, the Lord will give strength unto his people. The Lord will bless his people with peace. Psalms 29:11. We can trust these promises given to us in the Bible. Another reassuring promise in Science and Health says, blessed is that man who seeth his brother's need and supplieth it, seeking his own and another's good. Page 518. Acting in obedience to God's instruction, I forgot about myself and the woman, and I continued talking. Now, I hadn't reached out to this woman to gain a blessing, but after the tour ended and we exchanged hugs, I realized I had received one. I was completely well. It is true that we are not impoverished by giving to others in our service to God, good, who is our creator. When we drop self-centered concerns, doubts, and fears, and let God's love open our hearts to others, we will receive a blessing. From the Arts and Culture section. It's okay to read a poem and be baffled by it. Maybe there's one phrase that astonishes or surprises you. Make those moments the seeds that nurture you. Arthur C., the new U.S. Poet Laureate, on not being intimidated by poetry. Read more on page 32. A photo, color photo, of two women talking, one dressed in ethnic clothing, talking to a woman with a jacket and a scarf wrapped around her. They appear to be standing on snow, but inside a building with aspen or birch trees, and some of the sticks have lots and lots of deer heads on it. Caption, Indigenous Inspiration. Queen Sonja of Norway talks with Marit Ann Sara, a Sami Norwegian artist, about her sculpture, Guave Gabel, at the Tate Modern in London, October 13th. The piece relates to reindeer herders and the ecological challenges they face. Jack Taylor, Reuters. Q&A with new U.S. Poet Laureate Arthur C. on the joy of being baffled by poetry. In a world that moves faster every day, Arthur C. says poetry offers something increasingly rare, a chance to go slow. You can't speed read a poem, he explains. You have to read it, hear the sounds, the rhythms, reread it, not be in a hurry. Slowing down helps us realize that for our speed, we sacrifice things. Mr. Z., the 25th U.S. Poet Laureate, first found poetry intimidating and esoteric in high school, only discovering its joy while scribbling lines in the back row of a calculus lecture at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Cambridge. That early exploration led him to author more than a dozen published collections, culminating in his appointment as the official Poet Laureate of the United States. Ahead of his inaugural address at the Library of Congress on October 9th, Mr. C., who was also a National Book Award winner, spoke with the Monitor staff writer Troy Aiden Zambajan about not being afraid of being perplexed by poetry. It's okay to read a poem and be baffled by it, he says. Maybe there's one phrase that astonishes or surprises you. Make these moments the seeds that nurture you. His forthcoming book is Transient Worlds on Translating Poetry. This interview has been edited for length and clarity. With a photo illustration by Sean Miller, Library of Congress, of Mr. Z looking at the camera, a headshot, gray-haired man, slightly balding, longish hair, round glasses, smiling, pink shirt, pink-collared shirt, blue jacket, in front of a old cabinet with a picture of flowers in the front and a head of a woman on top of the cabinet. In this current age of technological disruption and distraction, what can poetry teach us about presence and attention to the moment? In our digital age, when things are moving so fast, people are oftentimes very disconnected. Poetry has a vital role to slow us down. We're on the surface too often, and when we slow down into our bodies, we can really connect more deeply to the language and the experience of a poem, and ultimately to other people in the world around us. That's a huge important thing that poetry does. You're the first Asian American poet laureate. How has your background as a second generation Chinese American shaped your poetic voice or sense of rhythm? Like many Asian Americans, I was brought up to do something safe and professional. That's how I started at MIT. When I started writing, I was so excited about poetry, I felt like I was discovering parts of myself that I didn't know existed. When I first started writing poetry, I wanted to draw on the Chinese tradition and learn from classical Chinese poetry. In doing that, I heard sounds I would hear in household conversations, you know, the way Chinese is spoken. I learned how, in ancient Chinese poetry, the sciences are choreographed as well as the sounds. That was a revelation to me. How do you encourage readers who might feel intimidated by poetry? My advice is to listen to the sound and to the rhythm. Don't worry too much on your first reading about trying to get it or feeling like you're inadequate if you don't get it, because poems can have many meanings. Different readers can have different insights into a particular poem. If a poem is good, if it's strong and alive, it exists on many levels. It has many layers. And I feel like different readers can bring their intuition and their experience and appreciate the poem. It's not like a math equation where there's a correct answer. You've described poetry as a way to slow down the speed of the human heart. How do you hope to help readers discover or rediscover that pace? Each recent poet laureate has a particular project in mind to raise the appreciation of poetry. I've chosen 23 poems from 13 different languages for a book that we publish next spring. Then I present 3 different translations of the same poem into English. By presenting 3 different translations, I'm trying to show that there are many ways of looking at poetry. I want to slow down and deepen the process of engagement. Each translator finds something of value to translate. And then, as an innovation at the end, I invite the reader to make their own translation of this poem and to carry it over into their own voice. I hope to use this book as a vehicle that can go into high schools, colleges, community centers, that it can be a vehicle to help people read, to appreciate poetry, and again, to really slow down and pay more attention. Photo illustration of Mr. Z, caption, wordsmith, Arthur Z attends the National Book Awards ceremony November 20th, 2019 in New York. Mr. Z won the award for poetry for his collection Sightlines. The photo is of him looking at the camera in a tuxedo with a medal around his neck and National Book Award logos in behind. Who are some poets today who give you hope for the future of the art form? Forrest Gander, Carol Moldaw, Kevin Young, Layli Long Soldier, Adrian Mateka, and Sherwin Bitsui. I pick poets that continually interest me. 2 of them are Native American writers and former students of mine, but these are all poets who I think are evolving, and I'm always interested in what they're going to do next. Do you think that there's an inner poet in all of us? How do we tap into that? I do think there's an inner poet in everyone, and there are different ways to tap into it. Sometimes it's when people find little oases of stillness inside of the commotion of their daily lives. It might be a moment when you just sit down and you close your eyes and listen to your breathing. I used to tell my students at the Institute of American Indian Arts, don't think you're writing a poem because then you're going to freeze up. Just open a page, write with intensity and with your imagination, and don't worry about whether it's prose or poetry. Whatever it is, just write one word after the other. There are opportunities each day for everyone to discover something. To Defending Ukraine, a curriculum, high schools add How to Fly a Drone by Scott Peterson, staff writer, November 4th, 2025, Bucha, Ukraine. Why we wrote this. Before Russia brought war into the lives of Ukrainians, the Defending Ukraine course featured marching and sometimes carrying wooden guns. The new reality-based curriculum includes hands-on work with first aid, radios, and drones. Photo illustration of a teenager in a large gym, a drone flying next to him. He's got a camera taking a picture of a round hoop that I imagine the drone is going to go through. Photo by Scott Peterson, Getty Images, the Christian Science Monitor. Caption, a student photographs a small drone as it is flown through an obstacle course, as Ole Azarov, an instructor of Defending Ukraine classes, teaches students to operate them in a sports gymnasium in Bucha, Ukraine, September 17, 2025. The Ukrainian drone pilot wears a set of white goggles as he works his magic over an obstacle course in a school gymnasium in Bucha. Ilya might be a 14-year-old student with limited training, but he becomes a drone-flying hero when his nimble fingers zoom a small drone around posts and under arches, creating the same unnerving drone buzz that is today ubiquitous on Ukraine's front line with Russia. When Ilya loops the drone repeatedly in tight circles through a small ring just 2 feet wide, applause erupts from appreciative fellow students who have come to watch the after-school drone club at work. Ilya says he relishes the joy of flying and is fascinated by these very precise moves with his dexterous fingers. It's his third time flying at the club, but he was so inspired after his first visit that he got hold of a computer simulation drone flying app to hone his skills at home. Now, Ilya's drone piloting prowess is part of a broader effort by Ukrainians to better prepare students to cope with and survive a Russian invasion that has burned for 3.5 years with no end in sight. Drone warfare now defines this conflict along the front lines, with nightly bombardments of hundreds of Russian drones against Ukrainian urban centers and energy infrastructure, and with Ukrainian retaliatory deep strike attacks on Russian fuel and refinery capacity. So as Ukraine mounts a nationwide revamp of its Defending Ukraine course curriculum, learning to fly drones is a key priority. The course, which is mandatory for all 10th and 11th graders, also focuses on life-saving tactical first aid and weapons handling and shooting. Photo illustration of two teenage boys sitting next to an older man who's pointing at something, explaining something about probably the drone sitting in front of him. They're in a high school gymnasium. There's a backpack next to one of the boys. They're all in sweats or jeans. Photo by Scott Peterson, Getty Images, the Christian Science Monitor. Caption, Ole Azarov, right, a Defending Ukraine instructor who first introduced his students to drone flying earlier this year as a personal hobby, teaches a student who gives the name Ilya center in the gymnasium in Bucha, Ukraine, September 5th, 2025. This Bucha after-school program was ahead of the national curve. It's the pet project of Ole Azarov, a Defending Ukraine and physical education teacher who took an advanced course on drone use and, last year, set up the Bucha Aces Club with his own resources. The new National Defending Ukraine program is in its beta phase, with 70% of Ukrainian students testing a curriculum designed, during wartime, to be far more practical than in the past. This is real life. I see a huge difference already. Children are much more involved when they have things to work with, says Mr. Azarov, who wears a NASA hat from a pre-war visit to the Museum of Flight in Seattle. He notes that the new curriculum includes hands-on work with tourniquets, radios, drones, and weapons safety. But perhaps the most motivating factor is the context of full-blown war in which Ukrainian students are learning these skills. I tell them, this is real life, and in your life you may be able to be in a position to save someone's life. So better you learn it here, so the more chances you'll be able to save a life, says Mr. Azarov. I see in their eyes that it interests them and motivates them, he says. I tell them, you have to understand that you're living in one of the most dangerous countries in the world right now. I'm not talking you into serving the army, or you yourself fighting in this war, but we're talking about this new reality that you have to open up your eyes to. That includes asking students, for example, who has tourniquets at home? Perhaps 4 out of 30 students raise their hands, but almost none of those four have one tourniquet for each family member. Photo illustration of the same gym, the same teenager using his phone to control a drone with the full obstacle course showing a hoop, a bridge, some pylons, and then a bunch of kids watching him do that from the stands. Photo by Scott Peterson, Getty Image, the Christian Science Monitor. A small drone flies through an obstacle course as Ukrainian students are taught to operate them. Ukraine's Ministry of Education is now completely upgrading its Defending Ukraine curriculum with millions of dollars in investments. I say, okay, but do you realize that every night there are Russian Shahid drones flying over our heads, Mr. Azarov recounts, and there is a possibility that a Shahid will strike, and what will you do? Will you be able to save someone? Will you be able to be saved? The new Defending Ukraine curriculum is a far cry from the pre-war course, with its roots in Soviet-era Defending the Motherland classes. Those lessons are widely remembered for students being forced to march Red Square style, for learning by rote the structure of the military, for using wooden guns as props for the real thing, and even for using stones as pretend hand grenades. Time to revamp the curriculum. When the Monitor first met Mr. Azarov in early 2022, invading Russian troops had only recently withdrawn from Bukha, a district northwest of Kyiv where more than 400 Ukrainians were killed, and which became synonymous with Russian atrocities. Bodies had been left lying in the streets, often with hands tied behind their backs and shot execution style. The pre-war Defending Ukraine course did little to prepare students for the full-scale Russian invasion. Mr. Azarov, exhausted and stressed from weeks of brutal Russian occupation, predicted then that Ukraine's visceral shared experience would one day be converted into a dramatically revamped curriculum that would impart why you would need to love and defend your country. This is happening now. With upgrading the Defending Ukraine course a top priority for Kyiv, the government invested more than $35 million this year and earmarked another $24 million next year to provide a concentration of quality materials and purpose-built locations. Our aim was a complete rethinking of this program, says Mikhailo Alochin, the head of the Directorate of School Education at the Ministry of Education in Kyiv. The new curriculum began taking shape in 2024 and should be fully in place for every student by 2027. It's a fantastic amount of money for the Ukrainian education system, says Mr. Alochin, of the long-term investment. But he has seen students take part in mock first aid courses where they evacuate battlefield casualties and can see they understand this is something very real. Photo illustration of a teenage boy with a what looks like a virtual reality headset and a PlayStation type controls in front of him, backpacks, same gym. Photograph by Scott Peterson, Getty Images, the Christian Science Monitor. Caption, a Ukrainian student learns to fly drones with special goggles in Bukha, Ukraine. In one sentence, students need to have the ability to save their own lives and those of their loved ones, he says. Because we are living in Ukraine, a rocket can fall or bombing can start at any moment, anywhere. That knowledge is not just knowledge. It can really save someone's life. I think these children are very lucky to have this course because of the practical knowledge, says Mr. Alochin. When I was taking the Defending Ukraine course, we were just rewriting copybooks for 2 years and learned the rules of the army. I held a wooden model of a gun one time during those 2 years. Drones in the news. The drone emphasis also reflects the technological trajectory of this conflict and the likely direction of future wars, Mr. Alochin adds. The children now in school see the news from the front line every day. They see the drones are flying to Ukraine from the Russian side, he says. They run to shelters with their parents, understanding that drones are a threat. Indeed, drones could not be more ubiquitous in this war. The UN Human Rights Council's Independent International Commission of Inquiry on Ukraine last week found that Russia had committed crimes against humanity by systematically targeting civilians with drones in the southern city of Kherson. Also last week, Ukraine's commander of unmanned forces, Major Robert Brovdy, a combat drone expert with the call sign Madiar, announced that his units had 15,000 vacancies. Though they make up only 2% of Ukraine's armed forces, he said in a recruitment pitch, the drone team accounts for 35% of all verified strikes against Russian targets. We have drones waiting for pilots, not the other way around, he said. For Mr. Azarov, the overhauled Defending Ukraine course and its critical drone flying module is a necessary and welcome evolution. It is happening, he says. You had a whole generation unprepared for war. Now we are catching up. Alexander Nasalenko supported reporting for this story. France updates rape laws after Pellicot case, but is recognizing consent enough? By Colette Davidson, Special Correspondent, October 31st, 2025, Paris. Why we wrote this. For many years, women's advocates in France have been frustrated by the absence of consideration of consent within the country's rape and sexual assault laws. That's finally changed, thanks in large part to Gisèle Pellicot. Photo illustration of Gisèle Pellicot smiling at the camera, sitting between a lawyer and a man in a shirt and white t-shirt underneath in a formal room. Photo by Manon Cruz, Reuters. Caption, Gisèle Pellicot Center attends a hearing in an appeal trial filed by one of the 51 people convicted in a mass rape trial at the courthouse in Nîmes, France, October 8, 2025. Women's rights defenders across France this week are lauding the heroism of Gisèle Pellicot as the French Parliament finished its fast-tracking of a landmark bill that changed the country's definition of rape and sexual assault. The Senate voted 327-0 Wednesday in favor of a bill that will add the notion of consent to the country's laws on rape and sexual assault, joining neighbors Germany, Spain, and Belgium in doing so. The law will now specify that any non-consensual sexual act constitutes sexual assault, and that consent must be informed, specific, prior, and revocable. The legal change comes in the aftermath of the rape trial of Dominique Pellicot and dozens of other men. Mr. Pellicot had been drugging and sexually assaulting his wife, Ms. Pellicot, for about a decade and inviting others to join him. Amid the harrowing, months-long trial, Ms. Pellicot became a feminist icon for the poise she showed under pressure. The watershed moment this week points to the power of a single case in changing mindsets, as well as a growing intolerance for sexual violence across French society. But women's rights advocates are careful not to get too optimistic. They say more work needs to be done to address how sexual assault and rape are viewed and prosecuted. We should celebrate this new law on consent, but simply changing a law is not what's going to change society, says Violaine de Philippe Abba, a French lawyer and women's rights activist at nonprofit Osez le Féminisme. For that, we need to take a deep dive. Photo illustration of the front of a courthouse with metal gates in front and a sign, a large sign on the front of the gate. Photo by Alexandra Dimou, Reuters. Caption, a sign reading, Gisèle, women thank you, hangs on the gates of the courthouse on the first day of the appeal hearing filed by one of the 51 people convicted in the Dominique Pellicot rape trial in Nîmes, France, October 6, 2025. Putting consent over the top. In many ways, French society has already laid the groundwork for its laws on rape and sexual assault to evolve long before the Pellicot case made headlines. It really started with the book Consent by Vanessa Springora, says Fatima Benomar, co-president of women's rights group Coude à Coude, Shoulder to Shoulder. On the heels of the hashtag MeToo movement, Ms. Springora published a memoir in 2020 about her relationship with French writer Gabriel Matzneff, which occurred when he was 50 years old and she was 14. The memoir opened debate about consent in France and led to the passing of new legislation that set the age of consent at 15. Several high-profile sexual assault cases have since gained traction. In February 2024, French actress Judith Godrèche received a standing ovation at the César Awards for her speech about sexual violence in the French film industry, including abuse she had experienced as a minor. This past May, once revered French actor Gérard Depardieu was handed an 18-month suspended sentence after he was convicted of sexually assaulting two women on a Paris film set. In September, he faced new accusations of rape and sexual assault. But it was the Pellico case that moved the needle on the concept of consent between two legal adults, says French lawyers, and pushed the bill more quickly through Parliament. Many of the accused in the Pellico trial said in their defense that they could not be guilty of rape because they thought they were simply taking part in a sex game between the couple, and had gotten Mr. Pellico's consent on behalf of his wife while she was, in quotes, asleep. Until now, there had been this idea that, oh, she's my wife, so I have the right to her body at all times, says Mr. Philippe Abbott, the lawyer. The Pellico case has raised awareness on what constitutes rape. The Pellico case has also shattered perceptions of what a rapist supposedly looks like. Mr. Pellico was a middle-class electrician, and the 51 men accused of sexually assaulting Ms. Pellico, including firefighters, truck drivers, a journalist, and a DJ, Mr. Everyman, as they were commonly referred to in the French media. But lawyers worry that because the Pellico case was so out of the ordinary, the new consent law will not help them when it comes to prosecuting the typical rape or sexual assault case. Most such cases involve couples or people known to the victims and lack hard evidence like photos or videos. Some argue that the previous French definition, which classifies sexual assault or rape as a sexual act involving violence, coercion, threat, or surprise, was already comprehensive enough. I don't know what this convoluted definition of consent means in real situations, says Béatrice Savareau, a lawyer who represented Dominique Pellico in last year's trial. Will couples need to sign a piece of paper before any sexual interaction? How do we know if they took their consent back halfway through? Feminist groups also say the consent law puts blame once again on the victim instead of the perpetrator by forcing victims to prove they withheld their consent before or during sexual acts. Nor does the law resolve the larger issue that up to 94% of rape cases in France are never prosecuted, according to a 2024 report by France's Institute of Public Policies. There is no French law that guarantees that all complaints must give way to investigations, says the Feminist Legal Action Group, a French collective, in a statement. Thus, the principle of consent could lead to a dead end in practice. Feminist groups and legal advisors across the spectrum agree that the real work needs to happen at a grassroots level by teaching the French, starting with school children, what it means to have appropriate relationships with one another. That means classes in school on sexism and gender relations and getting more men involved in the discussions. Photo illustration of two men, three women, dressed up with their hands crossed in front of their mouths. Photo by Andrea Alexandru, Envision, AP File. Caption, Judith Godrèche Center poses with hands covering her mouth upon arrival at Cannes Film Festival in Cannes, France, May 15, 2024. This new law is positive, but it's not revolutionary, says Ms. Benomar, the activist. We need to continue to lift the veil off rape culture and improve the way we think and talk about it. Thank you for joining us for the Christian Science Monitor Weekly Digital Edition, read by Shari Mukundan.
The content featured in this recording may not reflect the views of Aftersight or the presenter. For questions, concerns, or editorial feedback regarding the Christian Science Monitor, please contact them directly at customerservice@csmonitor.com or call 617-450-2300 Monday through Friday.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.